Welcome, everyone. We're going to roll another episode of the Far Middle Podcast out for you. I'm Nick Deolius, and as your host, I'm quite pleased to spend some time this week with you. How about a great sports dedication to start episode 183? This guy, our dedication subject, is well known for what he did in pro football, probably did more than any other person for the history of the game, a true founding father. But he's not as appreciated for what he did beyond the gridiron, and he should be. The man lived an amazing, long, productive life, and I wanted to share his story with you. He was born back in 1895, made it through the early 1980s before he passed away, and the changes that he saw over his lifetime in America as well as football, they had to have been mind-boggling. His formal name was George Stanley Hallis Sr., and his nickname, he had two of them actually, Papa Bear and Mr. Everything. Yeah, Papa Bear Hallis was an American Mr. Everything, a professional football player, professional coach, and a pro football executive. Now, that's what he's best known for. He was the founder and owner of the Chicago Bears and served as his own head coach over four different periods, those periods of time ranging from the 1920s to the 1960s, which is amazing. Hallis was one of the co-founders of the predecessor entity that became the NFL. He did that back in 1920. And in 1963, he became one of the first 17 inductees into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was the oldest person in NFL history to serve as a head coach up until his time. He was almost 73 years old when he coached the final game of his career in late 1967. But football wasn't his only notable life accomplishment. He was also a player for the New York Yankees in baseball. There are actually photos of him that you can see where he's wearing the pinstripes. He played in only 12 games as an outfielder back in 1919 for the Yankees, and he would famously claim from time to time that he was succeeded in right field by Babe Ruth, but in reality it was Sammy Vick who was succeeded by Ruth. It's a little bit of a white lie there by George Hallis. Now, he earned a degree in civil engineering from Illinois. He served in the Navy during World War I, where he played for a team at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station and was named the MVP of the 1919 Rose Bowl. Hallis scored a receiving touchdown and returned an interception, 77 yards in a 17-0 win in that game. That's right, 1919, the Rose Bowl saw the Great Lakes Naval Training Station team win, and Papa Bear Hallis was the Rose Bowl MVP. How about that? And Hallis was indeed a true football pioneer. The Bears were the first team to hold daily practices. He introduced that. They were the first to analyze film of opponents. They were first to place a tarp on the field when weather conditions worsened, and the first to broadcast games by radio. And Hallis was an originator of league revenue sharing when he offered to share Chicago's substantial television income with teams in smaller cities because he firmly believed that what was good for the league would ultimately benefit his own team. And his military training never left him. He was a firm disciplinarian, maintained complete control of his team, and didn't tolerate disobedience and insubordination by players. 63 years as an owner, 40 as a coach, 324 wins, 8 NFL titles. His 324 victories as a head coach, that stood until 1993 when Don Shula broke the record. Hallis was professional football, and he represented the potential of America, a fitting dedication for the Far Middle. I'd like to focus this episode of the Far Middle to discuss an intriguing topic that's fundamental to many issues we explored together the past number of years on this podcast. And I want to acknowledge what I thought was a brilliant thought piece by Matt Wolfson that was titled Two Forms of American Liberalism. Came across his essay in late September. I gave it a read, was wowed by it, and just knew it had to be the focal point of an upcoming Far Middle installment. And here we are. The topic goes back to a key philosophical differentiation that we've been highlighting on this podcast when on a range of related topics. Today in America, we tend to speak in binary form of conservative or liberal. And it's wrong to think that way because it's both too simple and it's also inaccurate. Let's start with the latter, why those binary labels are inaccurate. When people view the progressive movement today, for example, most equate it to liberalism. Wrong, because today's progressive movement is leftist, not liberal. And as we've discussed many times, there's a huge difference between being liberal and being a leftist. There's a massive difference. And thinking rigidly of conservative versus liberal is not only inaccurate, but it's far too simple, to the point of being misinformed. Many thought leaders that get lumped into the conservative movement today, they're not conservative at all, but instead they might be libertarian or a classic liberal. Now, libertarian views the individual as supreme and desires a level of government that is at the absolute minimum. And of course, that precipitates endless debate that goes on forever as to what the definition of minimum government can reasonably be interpreted as. And a classic liberal might have many shared characteristics with a libertarian, but a classic liberal is a slightly different species of political and policy philosophy. A classic liberal is a staunch defender of individual rights, looking to avoid any government or societal interference with the individual citizen's ability to choose for themselves. Now, I certainly fall into those two categories. Some days I feel predominantly libertarian, and some days I feel predominantly classic liberal, and it may be most days that I feel a little bit of both. Contrast that with a conservative and then a leftist. First, a conservative. Conservatives do have some level of commonality with libertarians and classic liberals in that they view the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the rule of law as sacrosanct. But conservatives often go a step further, in my opinion at least, and in a negative direction. Conservatives often wish to dictate an official national religion or a mandate that adheres to certain societal norms to be required. And in some instances, conservatives desire to stifle choice of the individual and say ban certain books. It's just different types of choices in books that they are looking to prohibit versus what a leftist would look to target. And speaking of the leftist, it is by far the worst, the most dangerous, and the most oppressive of any of the political philosophies that we just covered. Libertarian and classic liberal theory are great, but they're far from perfect. And conservative philosophy has its inherent contradictions, as we just discussed. But with the leftist or the progressive, what many today conveniently and erroneously mislabel as liberals, they get nearly everything wrong. The leftist wishes to strip all individual freedom from the citizen and replace it with decision-making by the state and by the expert, in exchange for a promise of safety and security of the collective, a false promise, by the way, that's never delivered upon. And I've always been curious as to how the appropriation of the mantle of liberal came to be wrongly commandeered by the leftist. And that's where the Matt Wolfson essay, The Two Forms of American Liberalism, provided a much-needed illumination. He lamented at the start of his essay that many people note liberalism is under assault in America, but no one seems to be able to define what liberalism is specifically. And his favorite definition of liberalism was one provided by John McGinnis. Liberalism has historically been marked by independent courts, free trade, protection of property rights, and a limited state, even if it incorporates social welfare programs. That's the McGinnis definition. Now, that summation by McGinnis seems pretty accurate to me. And there are a few historically prominent and popular political leaders of the West who embodied that very definition with what most today perhaps wrongly define as conservative. And two names in particular that come to mind are Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So under that definition by McGinnis, you could also make a reasonable argument that George Bush and even Lyndon Johnson embraced the spirit of the definition of liberalism in their policies. And I'm not entirely there personally. I view George W. Bush is a prototypical conservative, and Lyndon Johnson is one whose policies cumulatively started to border on being leftist. And by the way, I find both of those presidents fascinating and to a large degree quite likable personalities. But today, liberalism, it should be viewed as falling into two very different categories that would explain the difference between the Reagans and the Thatchers on one hand versus the Bushes and the Johnsons on the other hand. One category was defined by Wolfson as classic liberalism, and the second as managerial liberalism. Classic liberalism takes the approach of representative government that's strengthened by associations close to people. Think of free markets with limited and surgical government intervention, along with non-interventionism abroad when it comes to foreign policy. The founding fathers of this movement where thought leaders such as David Hume and Adam Smith, they saw the merit in growing a middle class and a powerful elected government. And they saw trade as the way forward, not war. And they saw the danger of excessive government intervention into markets, large government debt loads, and the downsides of imperialism. Now, managerial liberalism, very different. It looks to centralized government and large institutions that use the expert class of administrators, academia, and judges to design and to set policy. And it also views foreign wars as ways to protect interests abroad. The founding fathers of this movement, it came from continental Europe, places like France. And they believed that a strong government presence, it was necessary to do what? To drive society toward better conditions. Heavy government investment in the economy, the use of state debt, those were good things. And wars to build empire, they could be value creating under the right circumstances. Now, defining liberalism into those two philosophies, it starts to explain a lot of America and American history since World War II, and it helps explain much of what is going on today in America's divisive political environment. Things start to become much clearer. America in its infancy wrestled with these two competing views. Think of the founding fathers of the United States. You got James Madison as one of the stalwarts and flag bearers of classic liberalism, while Alexander Hamilton, he was the standard bearer for managerial liberalism. And they both desired the same features of American government, but for very different reasons and with very different intentions. Madison, for example, saw giving more power to a federal government as was a way to check the extremes of individual state governments, but not to create a strong and overbearing federal government. He wanted to broaden the political base to allow markets to prevail and to prevent one type of interest from dominating at some point in time. Hamilton, he had a very different view. He didn't have confidence in markets and thought that they could corrupt the individual. So his solution was a governance system that placed authority in a virtuous elite that would work through a federal government. Hamilton saw national debt as a good and necessary thing, and that representative government should function to support an administrative state. Now, these two greats, they worked together to draft and promote the Constitution, but then they also clashed for years over what the Constitution meant. And early on, the Madison view generally prevailed over the Hamilton view for America's first 150 years. And that's the inevitable overlap and rift between classic and managerial liberalism. It starts to make sense in hindsight. And indeed, it is evident that back in the day, classic liberalism sort of reigned supreme in America, but not exclusively and not always. Abraham Lincoln's a good case in point. He embraced the Jefferson and Madison philosophy when he won the presidency, but then as president, he enacted policies and decisions that were very Hamiltonian in nature. He introduced a banking system and a university system, but Lincoln did so by placing these policies more in the hands of the states, which shifted him back once again toward a Madison or Jefferson view of decentralized government and classic liberalism. You see a Madison view with a flavor of the Hamilton view of liberalism in legal doctrines. In the 1910s, Louis Brandeis advocated for expanded central power of government via antitrust policy to break up large corporations. But he did so with classic liberalism and that mindset by leaving most of the political initiative to the states, which he referenced as laboratories of democracy. The early periods of antitrust jurisprudence and policy in the United States, they were a step toward the Hamilton managerial liberalism view, but with the tactics leaving as much in the Madison sphere of classic liberalism as possible. But then somewhere between the Great Depression and Lyndon Johnson's policies, so somewhere between, say, 1930 and 1970, managerial liberalism superseded classic liberalism. And managerial liberalism now dominates American politics and policy. I suppose you could go back even further to the Woodrow Wilson era, where policy began to tilt America toward managerial liberalism. But certainly the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt served as a tipping point. And there are some who argue the tilt toward managerial liberalism, whether it be the New Deal during the Depression or much of American policy after World War II, that was an astute and a pragmatic approach to preserve a Western Republican democracy during periods of time of domestic unrest or geopolitical tensions. Now, this is the argument that says that the New Deal, for example, it was a necessary series of moves to ease the public's discontent during harsh economic times and to avoid some form of leftist movement changing America. Or it was needed for allowing America to mobilize all of its resources to rescue the rest of the world from falling to either the far right with the Nazis in World War II or to the far left with the Soviets in the Cold War. I'm not sure I agree with that assessment, but again, reasonable people can disagree on reasonable arguments. Now, something quite important that drove managerial liberalism over classic liberalism happened during the Cold War after World War II. Starting in the 1950s, the elites found in academia and corporate executive hierarchies and philanthropies, they were historically run by individuals who not only embraced Hamilton's view of managerial liberalism, but whose predecessors directly tied to the original thought leaders in Europe who helped Hamilton develop his views. There was a long lineage between the originators of managerial liberalism and the elite class that ran these institutions in the 1950s. And it was in the 1950s when these elites in these organizations outside of government, they began to cross over into leading positions within government, specifically the federal government in Washington, D.C. Government agencies began to embrace the philosophies of standardization and security and performance metrics, and government was growing rapidly, and it was displaying an aura of sophistication and enlightened progress. When there was inevitable conflict between elite government and representative government, it became increasingly common to see representative government demoted so that the policy aims of elite government could be furthered, which then led to even bigger government and wider managerial liberalism, perhaps best epitomized by LBJ and his policies, but also by Presidents Kennedy and Nixon. The proponents of managerial liberalism argued these policies and trends, they were necessary. Why? To protect the ability of the disadvantaged individual to achieve. But as time went on, it became apparent to most that it morphed into more of a power grab for the administrative state of the federal government to assume control of just about everything and everyone inside the United States. Heck, even proffered policy justified to reform government results in a larger and more powerful bureaucracy these days. Now, the obvious and big exception to this movement towards managerial liberalism over the past century or so of American history was, of course, Ronald Reagan. His policies went after everything from expansive domestic welfare to higher taxes to onerous regulation and so on. But when it suited him, Reagan did use certain aspects of managerial liberalism. Two cases in point were tariffs and his buildup of a government-sanctioned military-industrial complex to take on the Soviets. But after Reagan, the managerial liberalism movement struck back with a vengeance. And before you knew it, certain industries and certain corporations were too big to fail, meaning that when they experienced economic headwinds or they faced existential threats, the government promised their ongoing viability in exchange, of course, for bureaucratic control of the company or the industry. Foreign interventions, they expanded into places many Americans never heard of before, with our presence in the Balkans and the Middle East. And then deficit spending and government debt exploded as fast as the size of government expanded. And interestingly, managerial liberalism, whether embraced by the conservative or by the leftist, it began to embrace moral arguments for its justification. Big government and elite advocates on the right developed the concept of compassionate conservatism, while those on the left adopted the diversity through equity philosophy. Yeah, I find it beyond a coincidence that as managerial liberalism has grown in influence and dominance, America's condition has steadily eroded. And it certainly was a necessary ingredient and catalyst for spurring the initial popularity and presidency of Donald Trump. Ironically, even though he is far from a devout libertarian or a classic liberal. So it's not as if liberalism is in crisis today. It's that managerial liberalism dominates and has eclipsed classic liberalism in America. Free speech is now replaced with censorship, with the enlightened bureaucrat getting to decide what is disinformation. Property rights are no longer respected consistently. Instead, the bureaucrat decides which property is favored. And the concept of citizenship has been diluted and eroded with open borders. All of this under the careful guidance and wisdom of the elite employing managerial liberalism within a massive government complex. So classic liberalism, it's not dead. It's on the ropes, but it's not dead. The Supreme Court's recent decision that we discussed a few weeks back with Loper Bright and the Supreme Court reversing its own prior Chevron precedent, that is a great example of classic liberalism showing signs of life. Yet classic liberalism does indeed need to find stronger footing to lead the way forward for America. And we've all got a vested interest in that occurring as soon as possible. So the next time that you call someone a liberal or you are accused of being a liberal, demand from yourself or from the other party further clarification. Classic liberal or managerial liberal? If you're calling me a classic liberal, thank you very much. If you're calling me a managerial liberal, you got a problem? Let's wrap up this episode. This is one where we dedicated the time to bring a logical order to different flavors and versions of liberalism. We even started the episode with a sports dedication to a pioneer in professional football who introduced different innovations to bring an improved order to the game. So it's quite fitting that we close this episode with an innovator who brought order to things in another field, this one being chemistry. I am a chemical engineer by training, so this closing connection, it's an excellent end to an excellent episode, in my opinion. Now, his name was Dmitry Mendeleev, and he was from Western Siberia, and he had between 13 and 16 siblings in his family. His most important invention and innovation was the creation of the modern periodic table in chemistry. He brought logical order to a science that drives just about everything in modern life. In 1869, Mendeleev started to fiddle with a method to arrange elements. Before his periodic table, elements were typically grouped one of two ways, either by their atomic weight or by common properties that they shared. For example, with that second way, metals or gases would be grouped together. Mendeleev devised a method to organize elements in his periodic table that combined atomic weight and common properties. He brought them both together into one chart. So the periodic table organization we see today, you look at it and it seems obvious and it seems self-evident, but it wasn't before Mendeleev. Legend has it that he was inspired by the card game Solitaire, where the cards are arranged by suits horizontally and by number vertically. The periodic table arranges elements in horizontal rows known as periods and by vertical columns known as groups. And that's the genius of the periodic table. It shows one set of relationships vertically, another set of relationships horizontally. The vertical columns group elements together with similar properties. So you'll find gases of neon, argon, helium, they're together in one vertical column, while you'll find metals such as silver, copper, gold, in another vertical column together in the periodic table. The horizontal rows, they rank elements in ascending order by the number of protons in each nucleus or by atomic number. Hydrogen has just one proton, so it gets the atomic number one, and it appears first on the periodic chart. Elements toward the end of the periodic chart, they've got much higher atomic numbers and many more protons in each nucleus. Yeah, the periodic table placed chemistry into a format that allowed subsequent innovations and discoveries to take root and occur much more efficiently. Robert Krebs wrote in his book on the history of chemistry that, without a doubt, the periodic table of the chemical elements is the most elegant organizational chart ever devised. Yeah, I think he is indeed correct. There are roughly 120 known elements today. And I say roughly because there's scientific debate about some that may fall in the category of synthesized elements. 92 elements are naturally occurring, while the balance of the roughly 120 have been created in labs. When Mendeleev unveiled his periodic table, there were only 63 known elements, but he realized that the periodic table at that point in time didn't paint a complete picture and that there were likely many more pieces that were missing. And his organization under the periodic table, it sort of hinted where the new elements would slide in once they were discovered. So although we don't know how many elements will ultimately end up on the periodic table, We do know that the format and design of the periodic table will be able to accommodate them. Perhaps the best illustration of how genius Mendeleev was with his periodic table. A special thanks and note of appreciation on this dot with our last connection to the awesome author Bill Bryson and his telling of the story of the periodic table. He's one of my favorite modern authors and essayists. Now that's all for this week, constant listeners. Follow me on X and LinkedIn and YouTube to bridge you to next week. And as always, stay connected to that far middle.